Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Beulah Park in Grove City was the first thoroughbred horse racetrack in Ohio. That tradition ends on May 3rd when its doors close forever. Dublin resident Louise Goss told WOSU News reporter Sam Hendren that her father trained horses at Beulah Park for many years.
This is going to be gone, and it's a little bit like a death, but there's also some joy in all the memories. But it's been dying for quite a while. It's kind of time to get it over with.
So on the same day that the Kentucky Derby continues its 140-year tradition at Churchill Downs, Ohio's oldest racetrack closes after 91 years. Coming up this hour, we'll hear from historians about the past and consider the future of horse racing in America. Joining us now to talk about the present is New York Times horse racing reporter Melissa Hoppert. Welcome to the show, Melissa.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, we want to talk about the Kentucky Derby real quick. It's coming up day after tomorrow, and there is news. There's been a big scratch from the lineup. Tell us about that.
This morning, Hopportunity, he's the second choice in the morning line odds. He was scratched because of a injury in his hoof on his left front hoof, and they just noticed he was acting funny on the track, and he was kind of favoring that foot, so they decided to scratch him. They didn't want to take any chances with him. They seem to think that he'll be okay, but it's definitely the big news here. Everybody's been talking about it.
So what happens when they scratch one? Does another horse move up?
Yes, there's another horse that's on the outside who now gets into the race. So he'll move in. He'll have really long odds. So he won't be anywhere near the kind of horse that Hopportunity was. So it's kind of a bummer. A lot of people are talking about it. It's definitely the big news.
The Kentucky Derby is an American institution. People who never pay attention to the sport attend Kentucky Derby parties. They like people who celebrate St. Patrick's Day who don't have a stitch of Irish blood in them. And they wear big hats and drink mint juleps in celebration. Is the Kentucky Derby as big as ever?
I would say yes. They just put in this giant TV screen on the backside that you can see from the freeway, and it's just for people to come that are in the infield to actually be able to see the race, because sometimes if you're in the field, you can't even see anything.
Mm-hmm.
There are so many people jammed into this track already, and it's only Thursday. It's definitely a huge, huge event, and it seems every year like it just gets bigger and better and crazier. It's definitely fun. I mean, there's a great vibe around the event. I don't think the Derby is going anywhere. You know, everybody loves this.
The Derby's bigger than ever, but can it sustain when places like Beulah Park, even though no one's ever probably heard of it, or a lot of people have it outside of the racing industry, when places like Beulah Park can't make it?
I think so. I mean, a place like Churchill Downs, it's been around forever. It's like hallowed ground. You know, mm-hmm. People come here. It's a bucket list item to come to the Derby, to come to the Kentucky Oaks race on Friday. It's packed. I mean, anyone who comes here and sees it, there's no way that we won't have a Kentucky Derby. I mean, yes, do you need the tracks that feed the horses that get here? Sure. Mm-hmm. I was just at Keeneland Racetrack in Lexington, Kentucky last weekend, and they had a great crowd. And there's tracks like that that are doing well, definitely. Like Saratoga does well, Keeneland does well. I was at Santa Anita Park last week in California, and they just started a Twilight racing program, and there was a lot of people there. So for the big races, the big tracks, they're still pretty packed.
I guess it's 20 horses compete in the Derby?
Yes, 20 horses, unless there's 20 in the field right now, unless there's another scratch, and that's very possible. If anything, and if you want to know anything about horse racing, is that it's a game of luck, and trainers are so happy just to get their horses in the starting gate because anything can happen. We've had several scratches in the past couple of weeks. It's really hard. It's hard just to get there.
So with Hopportunity getting scratched this close, and you know it's possible another could scratch. What do they do? Do they have like runner-up horses waiting to run?
Yes, they do.
Okay.
Right now, they only had one other horse eligible, so he was waiting, and he's in now. So, you know, he'll be the end of the pack. So,
Okay.
His odds are not very good.
Because if they were good, he'd be there, right? Yeah.
His name is Pablo Del Monte, is the name of that horse.
Pablo Del Monte. My guest is Melissa Hoppert. She's New York Times horse racing reporter. We're talking about the Kentucky Derby right now, and we're going to move on. And we're also going to talk about just the past and the future of horse racing in the United States, in America. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. So, Melissa, 20 horses will race 1.25 miles at the Derby. Tell us how the Derby ranks as a challenge for the competitors, all things being equal. It's special because it's the first leg of the Triple Crown, but is it a tough race?
It's the hardest, I would say, one of the hardest, I mean, races that they'll go through ever in their career. There's 20 horses. You don't see that ever. It never happens. The Belmont's challenging because it's so long, but the horses won't race that long, but with a 20-horse field, you could be the best horse. You could be California Chrome, who's the favorite. And if you get a bad break out of that gate and you get stuck behind those 19 other horses, there's really nothing you can do. It's all about getting a perfect trip here. And that's the hardest part, is that you can have the best horse, but the best horses don't always win.
And how much do people, when people are betting on the horses, when people like you are observing and covering it as a journalist, how many factors go into success for any given horse? Is the track, the hardness of the track, that kind of a thing, whether it's raining or sunny or whatever?
There are so many factors. It's a little bit of everything. It's the track, you know, for instance, it's been raining here all week, so the track's been a little bit off, and you know, some of the horses have been struggling a little bit in their workouts or haven't really even been working at all because of the track. Mm-hmm. It looks better now. It's pretty much drying out, but, you know, some trainers are really concerned about the state of the track. A lot of times when it rains here for a big race like the Derby, you have these horses who come out of nowhere and win because they've raced before on a wet track where you have a favorite or a horse that people really like, mm-hmm. and they don't run well because of the track. But it's also, I mean, it's a little bit of everything. It's having a good jockey. It's getting a good position in the gate. They just announced all the post positions. And, you know, one of the horses that was favored, Wicked Strong, he got the 20 post. And only one horse in the history of the Derby has ever won from the 20 post. So that was definitely tough for them, because he would have probably been the second choice if he didn't draw that post.
Okay.
So it's just so hard. There's so many things that have to work in your favor to win a Derby.
I love these names, but it seems like they're really getting fun these days. They didn't always, you know, things like General A-Rod and
General A-Rod.
Opportunity.
Named after the baseball player, but he's named after his owner.
Okay.
Armando Rodriguez. He's the owner. Opportunity is named after a couple out in California whose last name is Hopper. And they always said, another day, another opportunity. And so I was definitely thinking about them today when the horse got scratched. And Wicked Strong is actually named after the Boston Marathon bombing. They tried to name him Boston Strong, but that name was already taken, so they decided to go with Wicked because of Boston and how everyone says Wicked. So, yeah, there's a lot of good little storylines with the name.
California Chrome is the favorite in Saturday's Derby, but I read one columnist lament that there's no real buzz over him. And how long has it been since there was real buzz outside of the horse racing industry over any horse? Now, I remember I used to ride horses and work in a barn during the Secretariat years, and those were great years.
Yeah, you know, I would say there was some good buzz last year with Orb because he was working so great and he had great connections. His family, the family that owned Orb, has been in horse racing forever. They're like the first racing family. So there was some buzz about him. I wouldn't say that there's not necessarily any buzz about California Chrome. He won the Santa Anita Derby in really strong fashion. He's been just really crushing other horses. So I would say there's buzz. I mean, there's a lot of people out at his barn in the morning checking him out and watching him get bathed and watching him go to the track. But I think you'd probably have to go back to Big Brown, maybe, was really a buzzed about horse. After Barbaro won the Kentucky Derby,
that's right.
Really was a huge, huge draw for the media and fans. And and everything. And then what happened to him in the Preakness was really awful. And the industry as a whole really started to kind of make changes then when he broke down. So he kind of was a huge catalyst in the industry for change. And so I would say Barbaro, Big Brown, probably back then.
And what about the jockeys? Do they generate much interest? Is there Danica Patrick among them, or?
There's definitely, Rosie Napravnik is the Danica Patrick. She's great. She has proven that it doesn't matter if you're a woman, you can ride in the biggest races. And she finished fourth last year, and that's the highest finish ever by a woman jockey at the Derby. So she's, I wouldn't count her out. She's on a horse named Vickers in Trouble, and he won the Louisiana Derby. So she has a real chance. He's kind of a tiny horse, but, you never know in these races. And that would be a great story if she won.
Yeah, I like the Vickers in Trouble, too.
She's definitely a huge, she's a huge draw. And the only thing with him is he drew post one, and it's another really challenging post to win out of, because you get squeezed along the rail when you come out of the gate. All the horses kind of crush in on you. So that'll be a little bit of a challenge for Rosie, but we'll see.
What about the ages of people who pay attention to these things? Now, of course, like I said, there's always the Kentucky Derby party. Everybody shows up. It's like the St. Patrick's Day party. Everybody's a Derby fan on Derby Day, right? But is there a generational gap here? Do you see that as a reporter? You're young. I mean, do you see people that look like you out there?
I think that's the biggest challenge facing the industry. You have the place like Beulah Park, where you probably had a higher age of people that went there, the old handicappers, the grizzled handicapping veterans. It's been a challenge for the industry to get young people to the racetrack. But I think they're starting to really figure it out. And I've always said that if you get young people to the track, they'll be hooked. It's almost just the factor of getting them there. But they've really been making pushes with social media and doing events like, drinking events and different specials, getting
there's
younger
always that,
people
isn't
to
there?
Go.
Right.
Well, it's become a social scene. I mean, going to horse races isn't what it used to be. You used to go just to watch the horse race. Now people go to a place like Keeneland or Churchill Downs. You have Louisville, the University of Louisville right here. You have Kentucky by Keeneland. And a lot of the students go to the track as a social event to hang out. You go to, the bars and the restaurants and you just go and see and kind of take it all in. And it really is a great experience. But they do have trouble as an industry getting people to go to tracks that, maybe aren't Churchill Downs, like a Beulah Park or a Thistle Down in Cleveland, where I grew up. It's not everybody goes to those tracks anymore.
Is it affordable?
I would say it's affordable for sure. I mean, a lot of these tracks you can get in for free. And then, the expensive thing is betting. But if you go mostly as a fan just to watch it, and you're, only putting down a couple dollars here and there, it's really affordable, and it's very fan-friendly. You could get really close to the horses. The trainers let you see them in the paddock, and they'll bring them by you, and you could go to the barns in the morning, and it's really a neat experience once you're there. But, yeah, it is a challenge getting people to go.
Well, Melissa Hoppert, thank you so much. Have fun this weekend.
Thank you. I will.
Melissa Hoppert, she's the New York Times horse racing reporter. Coming up, we're going to hear from historians and analysts and take a closer look at the horse racing industry in the past and predict maybe a little bit of its future. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm Ann Fisher.
Secretariat on the outside to take the lead. Sham holding in second. It's Secretariat moving away. He has it by 2.5. Sham then on the outside. Our native. At the wire, it's going to be Secretariat. He wins it.
That was Secretariat's win in the 1973 Kentucky Derby, when somehow horse racing reignited the imagination of a nation. Since then, its popularity has waned, ebbed and flowed, I suppose is a better description. And in part a reflection of that, the oldest track in Ohio, Beulah Park, closes on May 3rd after 91 years. Joining us now is sports historian and author of a recent paper about the cyclical history of horse racing, Stephen Reese. Hi, Stephen.
Morning.
Also with us is the editorial director of the Thoroughbred Racing Industry's weekly magazine, The Blood Horse, Eric Mitchell. Welcome to the show, Eric.
Good morning, Ann. Good to be here.
Stephen, you wrote about the cyclical history of horse racing for the International Journal of the History of Sport in March. You called it the nation's oldest and, in parentheses, sometimes most popular sport. Are we in a downturn now, or does it just seem that way because something like Beulah Park closes on Saturday?
Well, I say horse racing had a cyclical history because at one time, colonial period, it was the major American sport. In the 19th century, it had some problems with its legality, and so it had ups and downs. And by the turn of the century, there were only a handful of tracks open. And then it revived in the 20s and 30s and into the 50s and into the 70s. It was very, very successful. But now it's on a downturn, and now it's financially struggling.
To what extent is the proliferation of gambling opportunities across the country responsible for the downturn?
Now that's a major, major reason. If you ask people why they go to the tracks, obviously they go to have a good time. They go to meet their friends. They go to drink a little, as we're going to see the Kentucky Derby. Mm-hmm. But the big reason they go to the tracks is to gamble. And with the proliferation of other opportunities in the last 40 years, off-track betting, casinos, gambling on the Internet, and so on, gambling has become a lot more accessible without having to leave your house or go very far away. And so most people prefer particularly sports betting, which has boomed since the 1970s. And that's pushed horse racing aside, because horse racing used to virtually monopolize gambling in America, legal gambling in America, and certainly monopolize sports gambling. But now it's an afterthought.
Eric Mitchell, when it comes to covering the thoroughbred racing industry, to what extent does that include the gambling aspect of it?
Well, I mean, everybody in the industry understands that it's a wagering sport, and we pay as much attention to the handle as anything, because a portion of what's wagered goes to feed state incentive programs that benefit breeders and stallion owners, and a portion of that money goes to purse accounts as well. So we pay very close attention to it.
The racinos were supposed to help with the problems of the competition between the growing gambling opportunities, particularly in Ohio. How has that worked? Eric?
Okay. When the blend between casinos and racetracks first started, there were plenty of people that felt that a deal was being made with the devil here, and that you were inviting your competition into the track. And in the, you know, like some experiments in the early stages, you saw a lot of growth. The tracks that got slot machines or video lottery terminals or some alternate form of gaming, poker rooms, et cetera, did have the ability to enhance their purses that were paid. And, you know, you saw an increase in what owners could get on their return, kind of a renaissance of some of those tracks that didn't have money to pay out in purses previously. But over the long term, we've seen that level out. And part of that, as you mentioned, has to do with the proliferation of gaming. You know, it's no longer three or four tracks that are racinos that are enhanced by gaming. You know, now it is, you know, state after state after state that's expanding this offering. And, you know, clearly the amount of disposable income people have is going to get taxed pretty heavily drawn on pretty heavily as you make this more and more and more. I mean, it gets spread out. There's only so much disposable income out there, and there's other entertainment opportunities as well.
Stephen Reese, what do we know? Horse racing seems like the sport of the wealthy to a lot of people. And, of course, anyone can go to a track and see that that's not necessarily the case. Anyone can participate by observing and betting. But What about the cultural gap between the people who race the horses, people who own the horses, and the people who bet on them?
Well, not everyone who owns a horse is rich, but it seems if looking at the horses that are the most successful, those are, and have always been, the rich people. It's not by chance that horse racing has been called the sport of kings. If you're going to buy, if you're going to participate in a race like, you know, the races in Dubai where they prices are $10 million to the winner or $20 million, these are horses that cost a fortune, and only rich people are at that level. But the people who go to watch, they're going to be some of the rich people. You'll see some rich people showing up Saturday at the Kentucky Derby. But middle-class people and working-class people can go to the race because, again, as the previous spokesman talked about this morning, horse racing is not that expensive to attend.
She said it's often free to get in.
That happens, too. Sure, I went to Churchill Downs for free. Not on the Kentucky Derby.
Not in a few days. So when did horse racing, when did it become middle class or a game for common people?
Well, it was always a game that attracted working class people because of the gambling interest. And this was, you know, in the 20s, for example, when people who were working class wanted to make some money, one way they thought was, you know, they couldn't afford to do the stock market, was they used horse racing. They used the gambling to try to make some money. There were times in the late 19th century when a lot of the crowds in Chicago, for example, were working-class people, but these were tracks that were very money-oriented. They were proprietary. They were not run by the elites like we think of horse racing generally is with the jockey clubs and groups like that. So the working class always were able to attend, and they've always made up a big part of the population. And in fact, in the 20th century, in American cities, the working class was a big boom to the horse racing industry.
And what happened?
I think what the previous spokesman also pointed out, it's gotten a very older audience, and it's had a hard time attracting younger people. And that's why places like Churchill Downs on Saturday is going to be like a carnival. That's one of the reasons they're trying to attract people. How are the ways they're going to get people? In Chicago, at Arlington Park, they try to get the whole entire family to come in and enjoy the experience of being in the fresh air and watching the horses run. So marketing is very, very much what the horse racing business is doing today and trying to get a broader audience than it seems to be getting for the last 30 years.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I'm talking with Stephen Reese. He's a sports historian, and also Eric Mitchell of the weekly magazine, The Blood Horse. If you have a question or comment about horse racing in America, give us a call. One of these guys can probably answer your question, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Eric Mitchell, how long have you been covering the business of horse racing, and how have you seen the marketing change over time in the last 10 or so years?
Well, I mean, I've been covering racing from a journalist, as a journalist, since 1988.
Okay.
As a day, you know, working at a daily newspaper in Ocala, Florida, which has a very, very strong thoroughbred breeding industry. And then, since at the Blood Horse since 1999, I'd like to throw in something because we were talking about horse racing and its accessibility, and
yes,
you know, whether it's a sport for the wealthy or not. And I would say that, you know, over the period of the last 20 years or so, the sport has become much more accessible to people who aren't the CEOs or, you know, co-owners of Fortune 400 companies. Through racing syndicates, you see a lot of people who are able to buy into 25% of a racehorse, sometimes even own 5% of a racehorse, and get that sense of ownership. You know, go to the racetrack, be an owner, be a participant, have a chance to sit in the winner's circle. You know, so are there horses that are very, very expensive? Sure. But it's not the favorite of the Kentucky Derby this year. I mean, it's owned by two guys who own small businesses. They've spent only a few thousand dollars on the mare that they bred to a very modestly priced stallion, and now they're at the pinnacle of the sport. So, yes, you know, there are very wealthy people who participate. Yes, there's a lot of money that is spent on the game, but you know, what I heard was that, like, there's two different audiences. There's people who are fans who bet on the sport mm-hmm. and watch it on TV and follow what's going on. And then there's people who are the actual participants, the owners and breeders. And, you know, they're not all fabulously wealthy people. They're very hardworking farmers I think is an accurate way to put people who are in the a big number of people who are in the breeding industry. But let me go back to your question. And I think you had asked about marketing.
Yeah, how it's changed to change who shows up.
Well, you know, that's the challenge right now. And I think no one would dispute that horse racing did not do a very good job of marketing it itself because it has been treated largely as a local sporting event for whatever market the racetrack is in. And so kind of marketing and promotion was left to the individual racetracks. There wasn't anybody who was out there trumpeting the sport overall like the NBA would or the NFL would or,
right.
you know, any of the other major sports. So there was the formation made of the National Thoroughbred Racing Association, and part of its mission was to promote and market the sport. And, you know, it had some mixed results, but it didn't last. I mean, it wasn't a sustainable model the way it was put together. And so now you see other groups stepping up that have stepped up. The Jockey Club in the last couple of years has stepped up and created a website that's more fan-oriented. They've done deals with NBC, so now you'll see a lot more horse racing just in the last couple of years that has been on TV through the NBC Sports Network. So I would say could it be better? Sure, it could always be better. I think every sport, you know, wants to grab as many fans as they can and convert them. I would say that the marketing and the exposure of thoroughbred racing is better over the last couple of years than it probably was the previous 10 to 15 years.
Did the economic downturn, the recession, affect horse racing per se?
Oh, absolutely. I don't know if there was any business that
right.
wasn't affected by the Great Recession. The thoroughbred industry got a double hit, however. At the leading into 2008, the foal crop, number of thoroughbreds that are born every year, mm-hmm. Was very, very high. And so the demand was not matching what the supply was. And so we were already starting to see signs that the commercial market was headed for some trouble. And then 2008 comes along, and not only did were we faced with our own internal economic situation, imbalances, supply and demand, then the whole world market freezes up and nobody has any money to spend on anything. And certainly, you know, thoroughbred racehorses was much lower on the priority list. And so it went through a huge correction. Now the foal crop is significantly less. And we're now seeing last year was probably the bottom that we saw in the commercial market. Now it's starting to come back up. You've got fewer horses out in the market. When that foal crop changed, you saw the lesser value, the less expensive horses, breeding stock were the ones that got weeded out of that mix. So now you're left with a higher quality crop. And demand is now stronger, and we've seen significant gains in the auction markets.
We have a Facebook message from Mark, and I'll shoot it to you, Stephen Reese, just for kind of a historical perspective. But, of course, Eric, you're always welcome to chime in. He asks, is treatment of horses an issue in sports popularity or the maltreatment of horses? Stephen Reese, historically, what about that has our attitudes about animals changed how we look at horse racing?
Even back in the late 19th century, when the founding of the American Society for Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, which, by the way, came before the Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Children, there was always been concern about the treatment of animals. especially of horses. Horses used to be ubiquitous in city streets. You need them for trucks and all sorts of other purposes. Racehorses in particular, they've been a concern because for about 100 years, they've been giving them drugs for better, for lesser purposes. They've been using batteries to get them to run faster. And especially since the 1970s, this has become a big issue among the American public. I don't know necessarily what percentage it is, but they know that trainers use Lasix. Sometimes they abuse Lasix. The cruelty and dangerous quality of the sport was unfortunately demonstrated by the canceling of the TV show Luck, which is an HBO production. I think three horses died in three or four weeks of the show, and they had to cancel it. And there've recently been a congressional hearing on the health of jockeys and horses. So there is concern about the welfare of the animal.
And Eric Mitchell, what has the industry done to address those concerns?
Well, I mean, it is certainly a top priority. And although you could argue from a lot of different standpoints that the issue hasn't moved quickly enough on some issues, and I would say that if, you know, the thing that the industry probably has fallen short on the most is the enforcement of rules that are already on the books and issuing penalties to people who don't want to follow the rules and who are the bad apples in the bunch, if you will, and making the penalties stronger. So medication is a big issue. It's being talked about now, and you know there's this balance between what is a therapeutic medication, because they are athletes and there is muscle soreness and they do come up with aches and pains and they have inflammation and you know, like you would treat any other athlete, you need to have some tools that are available. The question is, what's in that horse's system when the horses run? And, you know, you have to go through vigorous testing to be sure that those horses are clean. They have vet exams. Pre-race vet exams have been one of the most successful programs tracks have implemented. Horses are looked at back in the barn area before they run. There's vets that are in the saddling paddock that are looking at them to be sure horses are sound. They're not showing any sort of indication of discomfort. The industry has also been pushing a uniform medication and penalty policy, which is working its way through a number of different states. And, I mean, that's what it's trying to do, is trying to create a more level field where testing results are the same from state to state, penalties are the same from state to state. But the way the structure is in the United States, that's a huge challenge because gambling is in the purview of individual states. I mean, it's up to them to set their rules. That's been the history.
And that's the agency that oversees horse racing.
By state. Racing, individual racing commissions are the ones who are responsible. But then to try and get 32 racing states to all agree on the same level of medication, same level of testing, use the same labs, have the same standards in those testing labs, it's a huge task. And so the discussion right now is, does the industry need some sort of federal oversight, federal umbrella that will set the standards, and then, you know, it's one standard that everybody has to conform to. So, I mean, there are a lot of things that are trying to be done, but the way the structure is in this country, it's a huge challenge. And so, I mean, that's why there's more and more talk about some sort of federal oversight and maybe getting the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency involved and have them do for racing what they did for the Olympics.
They have a lot of work already out there these days with all the doping, but we will continue. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm Ann Fisher. At a recent ceremony marking the close of Beulah Park, Ohio's oldest thoroughbred racetrack, Grove City resident Mary Molchan shared her thoughts with WOSU News reporter Sam Hendren.
Lived in Grove City my whole life, and this has just been something I think we took for granted. And I can remember Saturdays as I was a child, Broadway would just be packed with vehicles coming to the racetrack. And now it's gone. And it's sad.
But is the sport over? The Akron Beacon Journal reported in January that it's on the rebound. So how do we explain the failure of Ohio's oldest track? We're talking about the past and the future of the horse racing industry today with two experts, sports historian Stephen Reese. Stephen, thanks again for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure.
And also Eric Mitchell of the Thoroughbred Racing Industry's weekly magazine, The Blood Horse. Eric, thanks again.
Oh, thank you.
Let's just go straight to Albert in Dublin. You wanted to address that issue. Hi, Albert.
Yes. I'm emeritus professor of equine surgery at Ohio State, and I started breeding horses of both breeds, harness and thoroughbred, in 65, in 1965. That's how my kids learned to work. We've had three thoroughbred tracks and four harness tracks in Ohio for many, many years, and we continue to have those seven tracks. Unfortunately, when the industry got really sick in Ohio, because we did not have video lottery terminals, slot machines,
right.
Other states took our horses and our people and the breeding to their states, and so we really got in the doldrums. In 02, we were breeding more harness horses in Ohio than any other state or nation, and there are several, you know, down under and in Northern Europe, mm-hmm. they have breeding of horses of both breeds. Ohio's racing was so sick that the big gaming companies were able to buy a controlling interest of six of the seven tracks, and only one of them now is independently owned. And there's a lot of politics involved, but I won't go through all that.
Okay.
But just to say that Governor Strickland tried to get BLTs at the track because it would have solved $1 billion of his $3.2 billion deficit at that time. But the Republicans, in the person of Bill Harris, president of the Senate, mm-hmm. and the Ohio Supreme Court, prevented it from happening.
Okay.
Unfortunately, when Governor Kasich took over, it took him 18 months before he instituted the video lottery terminals. And now racing is back and in really getting revived. And the breeding farms that went out of business are now being replaced by other breeding farms. We're getting the horsemen that went to other states are coming back.
Okay.
Back. I'm talking about the workers,
uh-huh.
the grooms, and
right.
all that. So that's just a perspective of what's happened
okay.
In the industry.
Albert, thank you so much. So things can turn around fast, right, Stephen Reese?
Well, yes, they can, but normally these take a long period of time. In horse racing in America, for example, something people don't remember because it was 100 years ago, oh, the racing business almost went out of business completely. In 1910, there were only about two dozen tracks operating in the United States.
You mentioned
New
that earlier.
Closed, those were closed.
How did that happen? Why did that happen?
Well, as we all know, horse racing comes with gambling. And
oh,
the
that's
eyes
right.
of many Americans, especially middle-class Americans at the turn of the century, this is a sinful activity.
Mm-hmm.
And it was something that should be eliminated. Plus, it was very tied into urban machine politics, which is also something people were very unhappy with. And so there's a big moral dilemma for horse racing. And in the turn of the century, it almost died in the United States. In fact, by 1910, except for Maryland and Kentucky, all the big racing states were closed. So this is how close horse racing was to collapsing. But then in the 1920s, it made a humongous comeback. And dozens and dozens of new tracks were opened up. And one of the reasons was states hoped to make money.
States hoped to make money from the fees and taxes on what people were making. So there are many hands that get into this sport, and sometimes that's good and sometimes that's bad. But it became an extremely popular sport again. And in fact, by the 1950s, it was the most popular spectator sport in the United States. And this is something, you know, today we don't recognize. But as long, not by 1980, it was still number one. But in the last 3 decades, it has declined. It's declined very dramatically. It's struggling to make a go of it. In fact, since, 2000, the paramutuals have dropped by 25%. And the number of races have dropped by 40%. But given the history of horse racing, there is hope for it to make a comeback.
Deb in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Deb.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I know you touched on a little bit on the treatment of the horses, but I kind of wanted to talk about the dirty little secret of horse racing themselves, because I was at a auction for Last Chance Corral in Southeast Ohio not too long ago, a couple years, and they take foals that would that are born to mares that are specifically bred just to provide milk for the thoroughbreds, and then the foals are actually killed. And unless it's for rescues like this, that they take some and they can't take them all. But right. I was really shocked when I found this out, and I've never really been much into horse racing, but I would never, ever go. And I wonder if, like, more people are becoming aware of things that the horse racing industry does, and if that's affected how maybe... Well, the decline.
Yeah, well, we've certainly talked about that on the show before, Deb. Eric Mitchell, can you take a swat at that one? It's pretty controversial.
Yeah, what you see, she's talking about using nurse mares, and, you know, can I sit here today and say that everybody who bred a non-thoroughbred mare for the being for the purposes of a nurse mare didn't put down that foal in some way, or, you know, has that ever happened? Sure, I'm sure that's probably happened. I will also say that there are people who are in the nurse mare business that they recognize there are some older thoroughbred mares that don't produce as much milk maybe as they used to, and they put these their foals on a non-thoroughbred mare to nurse. But I also know that those non-thoroughbred foals, in a lot of cases, are bottle-fed. And it is not the matter of course or matter of practice to simply put those foals down and dispose of them. So there are people that do immoral and unsavory things. And, you know, it's our job, as it is with any industry and any job, to weed those people out and to make it so they are no longer participants in the sport. You know, that's a tougher issue to address because, you know, horses are private property, and, you know, the amount of policing you would have to do to ferret that out would be extensive. So I think it's sort of a self-policing thing where if somebody does business with somebody else and they find out that they are doing something that they feel is inappropriate, you stop doing business, you stop supporting them, and hopefully they go off and find something else to do. But those are the kind of things that we wrestle with, and the medication is the same way. Mm-hmm. You know, you have trainers that are looking for an edge, they're looking for ways to get around the rules, and the industry has a responsibility to ferret those people out and enforce the laws and make them stick and make it so the sport says we don't want that kind of participant in this sport and be heavy-handed about it.
Thank you, Deb, for that call. We appreciate it. Last week, the Blood Horse reported on the issue of one man's effort to restore integrity in racing by changing certain house rules and those dealing with drugs in particular at 6 of his tracks. And Eric Mitchell, to what extent do you think it's going to have to, ultimately, you mentioned how the states have to, you're looking at a federal, possibly a federal regulatory role in all of this, but how much does it have to change from the inside, too?
Well, and I think you're talking about Frank Stronach, and
yeah.
Frank Stronach is the founder and chairman of the Stronach Group, and he owns 6 different racetracks. And, you know, one of the reasons that his list of things that he came out with that he wants to do to help restore integrity of the industry, one of the reasons that is significant is because he is saying the house rules of a racetrack, my ability, my right as a business owner to say how business is going to be conducted on my property, that's what he's using. And he's not saying I'm going to wait on the Racing Commission to decide or to pass the rules. And in the case of Florida, the uniform medication and penalty proposal that is out there has to go through the legislative process before it can be adopted. And every state is, you know, again, every
state
is
different
how they treat these rules. In Florida, it's a legislative issue, you know. So now you're at the mercy of the pace of the legislature to get around to voting on and debating a bill. And sometimes that process can be painfully slow. So here you have a track owner who has stepped up and said, look, these are the issues that I feel are important, and I'm going to enforce them at my own property. So in some ways, in a lot of ways, it accelerates the reforms.
Someone compared Stephen Reese, I'm sorry, would you like to weigh in on that, or are these more modern-day issues that they're in the process of being resolved?
No, these are things that are really very contemporary. Eric is much more on top of this than I am.
Someone compared horse racing to ice hockey and its watchability on television. Now, I think hockey's improved with technology. You know, you can watch it better. It's just better with HDTV. But a horse race is still just a few minutes long with a lot of buildup. Does that cut it in today's ADHD world, Stephen Reese?
Well, it's interesting. There was a recent study of the popularity of American sports, and the National Hockey League came out ahead of horse racing, which placed 13th among American sports. And the 13th is not very good for a sport that once was the first or second most popular sports in America. And I think it has been hurt by television. In the 70s, horse racing was really supported by television when you had the great races of Secretariat, for example, which everyone was tuning in to watch. But nowadays, contrary to what I think Eric says, I don't think horse racing is on, you know, the major networks all that much. And watching a horse race, I think, does not have the excitement that you have when you attend a sporting event, when you attend a race. Now, hockey has a similar problem that it's very, very hard to follow the puck. But there's nothing too much more exciting than a NHL playoff game like people may have seen last night. And watching a race on TV, I think, just doesn't seem to do it.
What about that, Eric Mitchell?
Well, you know, I think that it goes back to your marketing question and how you present the sport. And, you know, Stephen, I didn't mean to imply that, you know, the bigger races are out there on network television every week, because they're not. There are racing networks, TVG, HRTV, which are devoted to providing racing on a daily basis. But I think what he's talking about, you know, is getting people engaged in what that race means. And that's one of the reasons that people, you know, follow the Triple Crown races, because you get a chance, the networks devote coverage, the media devotes more coverage overall into who the players are, who are the owners, who is the trainer, who is the jockey, what is his history, where did he come from, how did this horse get to be as good as it is, you know, what is, you know, it's those kinds of stories behind the stories is what makes the race engaging, you know, and when
just like with any sports,
proper,
really.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you know, you want to know any individual, you know, pick out a player, you know, you want to know his history. What's he like? What's his demeanor? What's his strengths? What's his weaknesses? You know, how's that likely to play out in whatever contest you're getting ready to watch, and what role are they going to play? And that's, you know, that's what's going on this week, is everybody looks at and handicaps the Derby field. You know, who are the horses that are going to be at the front? Who's going to be in the back? Who's likely to make that late charge? You know, the owners of California Chrome are a great story. You know, they are humble horsemen who just love their horse. I mean, it's a homebred horse. They have been with this horse since it took its first step.
Yep.
They have watched it blossom. They've watched him compete at the highest level. And that's made a very compelling story and is one of the reasons this horse is the favorite going into the race.
Eric Mitchell, we have to end it there. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, well, thank you, Anne. It's been a pleasure.
Eric Mitchell, he is editorial director of The Blood Horse Weekly Magazine, and also Stephen Reese, sports historian. Thanks as well to you.
Oh, thank you very much for the opportunity.
And thanks to the All Sides staff. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.